these days I'll finally get the tools down, right? I'd like to start with our Candy Bart Award, which is always one of my favorite things to do. And this week again, we have a multi-people recipient of this award. As Tim mentioned, we've had a lot of people working on the catalog, and thank you all, for all of you who've put time into it. And the management team, as they got together, they thought there were three particularly people that have really helped us during this time when we're just working on a lot of different projects, and they asked us to specifically request, appreciate all three of those. And I'll just basically read what they'd said. The first one is Christiane, who helped with a number of catalog formatting tasks, was an enormous help in getting pricing resolved, and has helped both Amber and Janelle with their product development projects. Thank you, Christiane. Appreciate it. Enjoy. The next one is Liz, and I don't know if you're here. Are you here, Liz? Oh, sure, you're there. Some of us couldn't see, right? Oversaw the photo shoot on her own. Thank you very much. It's a huge undertaking. It means you're collecting all the materials, getting it all ready for when the photographer comes in, and making sure he has everything he needs, and has been Linda's right-hand person with coordinating proofing projects. Thank you, Liz. Appreciate it. And Lindsay helped Anne-Marie edit testimonial edits, and I want to tell you that John said, wow, the testimonials are really, really good, so thank you. item descriptions and captions. Thank you, Lindsay. Appreciate it. Ooh, thank you. He wanted me to, the team also wanted me to give an honorable mention. Maybe that's a category we have to add. No candy bar, you get your name listed. Beth, who helped with pricing comparisons of 3-4, Core 5, and Core 100 for our Pinching Pennies article. Are you here, Beth? Thank you. Honestly, I'm just looking over at people. Maybe I need glasses. Rhonda did a massive amount of spreadsheet work with all the program and item number changes. Thank you, Rhonda. And Christina, who I don't see. Not here yet? Here's come. Okay. Jumped in and helped with pricing and helped Linda with obtaining the appropriate mailing permits. So thank you, Christina. when I asked Wayne what I should talk about after just getting back from a relatively long vacation, I said, do you think people would be at all interested in hearing about our trip? He said, oh, I think they really would be. Let's hope he's right, because that's what I'm going to talk about. It's very interesting. When you read articles about key leaders, they often say things like, boy, they just didn't do a lot of international travel. I think I read that a lot under President Bush, and I also read it just before President Obama became president. And part of what people say is, if you don't travel, you don't understand how the other companies of the world exist. And I'm here to tell you, they are very different than how we live. I'd like to start with where we started on our journey. We started in Singapore, which when you look at it, you think, wow, that's a very Western city. Lots of development. Overall, all of China, you have all those huge cranes. They call it their national bird, where they're doing all this building. It's a very modern-looking city. If you could do the next photo, Luke, do several more. As you drive around, there's beautiful cars. There's no ragged, beat-up vehicles. That's the freeway overhead. Because it's a small area, they've worked very hard to make sure all of the space is being used effectively. Take a next couple, Luke. Here's a gorgeous mall. Shopping is just the national pastime in Singapore. Everybody spends time in the mall. Beautiful, beautiful buildings, gorgeous facilities. As you drive by, you think, oh my goodness, it just looks so Western. And I think, let's pause there for a minute, because I think we need to recognize that while it looks very Western, it is not at all Western in their government policy. This would be a totalitarian government, and you say, well, don't they have elections? Yes, they have elections, but how it works in Singapore is everybody at the age of 18, all males, are required to join the military. And they do it really smart, where each person gets a specific job, everybody, so that if there's a time of national disaster, everybody can step into a position and know exactly what to do to help in the defending of their country. The problem with it is as members of the military, they're not allowed to vote against their commander-in-chief, which would be the person running for office. So it's one of those things where you think, okay, they have elections, whew, good, but they are not free elections. That's one example. A little bit ago, there was an article in the paper that talked about a young man that was going to be caned for doing graffiti in the city. It's against the law. It's also against the law to chew gum in Singapore. Totalitarian government. They are going to make sure this is a beautiful city, and it is. It's beautiful. What caning includes is you have a person who has been trained in how to administer the punishment. It's done on the bare buttocks, and it's based on the number of blows. They do it with a bamboo rod, bamboo stick, and the first blow breaks the skin. So depending on how many strokes you have, you absolutely cannot sit for weeks. It's very, very, very painful. And this was done to an expat. That's why the uproar was up. They do it to their own people all the time. This was somebody who wasn't even Singaporean. And because he lived in this land, this was part of his punishment. Capital punishment is a huge part of what they do. Because Singapore is a huge bay, and they have a huge dock area where they have all kinds of containers that come through. It's kind of a central location where everybody from Asia ships to Singapore, and then it gets disseminated around the world. Because of that, of course, you have a lot of drug traffic. And they have chosen to execute anyone that is transporting drugs through their land. I know of someone who wrote a letter of protest to the government and said, oh, I'm not sure we should do capital punishment, which I guess is done regularly on almost a daily basis. And for that letter, she was denied citizenship, although she had been born in Singapore. She taught in Singapore. All her family and friends live in Singapore. And she has been denied access for life from her homeland. Very different part of the world than where we live. If you want to gamble, which I don't have any pictures of that, but they have beautiful gambling halls, and people come from around the world to gamble there. If you're Singaporean, you have to pay a $100 entrance fee to enter the gambling hall. No one else has an entrance fee. And they do that so that, of course, their Singaporean culture gets richer, whereas all the wealth then flows into the land. You know, smart, but it's, again, a relatively controlling aspect of your life. Our taxi driver said, boy, I'd like to go and gamble, but who can pay that money? Very interesting. You also have enforced savings, even if you're not Singaporean. We have friends that live in Singapore, and a certain percentage of all of their paycheck automatically goes into savings. Singapore chooses not to do social services, and I think this is probably how they're planning on caring for their people. Another aspect about Singapore that I found very interesting is they have enforced housing limits. So if you have an apartment building, you must match the population percentages within your apartment building. So Singapore is, say it's 70% Chinese. In your apartment building, you have to have 70% of your apartments leased to Chinese people. 15% have to be leased to Malay. 10% have to be leased to Indians. It's just a controlling aspect. You know, they said, well, partially that keeps communities from rising up, like you have in France, where the people are angry and throwing sticks and burning cars. But it also keeps you from having the interesting community areas like Chinatown or Indian suburbs, or because it's all very homogenized. Everybody's shared up exactly the same. Just a little insight on this. Are there a few more on Singapore? Look, this is also another picture of Singapore. Beautiful traffic, beautiful buildings. Okay, so that was Singapore. And I'll have to figure out how to do photos a little better. But that's kind of a picture of a city that looks west, but is not west, right? From there, we traveled to Thailand. And this starts a journey where we visited countries that are based on not totalitarian anti-religion like Singapore, but to lands of the world that are very strongly Buddhist. They figure there's 1.25 billion Buddhist people in the world, and most of them happen to live in this region of Southeast Asia. It was really the first time I had had a lot of contact with this part of the world, and I plan on doing some research and talking with you one of these weeks on the whole Buddhist mindset and philosophy. I have not studied enough that I want to talk about that today, but we will come back to that. I think when you're talking about that many people to be aware of what they believe and what they understand and what they know, it's probably important for us to know. The Buddhists have gorgeous shrines. People live in very poor housing, but their temples, their shrines, are gorgeous. They're gilded with gold. They're beautiful. I mean, they're beautifully painted. They're beautifully manicured. You'll have bushes that are shaped like animals. And it's just, you know, when you walk up the grounds, or they have incense burning. It's quite an experience. If you could do a few more photos, look here. Some of their national treasures, the things that all tourists go and see, one of them would be, for example, this giant Buddha. And he's up on top of this whole big platform, and I think there's, I don't know, 50 steps that you climb up. And there's bells around that people go and hit with sticks so that you can hopefully have Buddha hear your prayers. It reminded me a lot of when Elijah was on the Mount Carmel in the Bible, and the prophets of Baal are trying to get attention of their god, and Elijah says, "Oh, shout louder," and maybe he's sleeping. And when you hear people ringing little bells to try to get the attention of your god, you think, "Wow, it's just a very different way of it." Here, next picture is a woman who's praying. This is what they do. They'll buy an incense stick or a prayer stick, and they light it on a little fire and bow. There's a lot of head bowing down to the ground and putting these little incense sticks in these troughs in hopes of that their prayers might be heard. Next picture, Luke. This woman, very interesting. What you buy are little pieces of paper with gold leaf on them, actual gold, real gold, and they will go and actually rub this gold leaf on the part of the Buddha that they want to somehow have contact with. So maybe she wants him to speak to her, give her information. But you'll see it putting on the hands or on the feet or on the ears of the Buddha. And again, it's an attempt to get the attention of a god that you just really want to hear from. The next one, Luke. Very strange structures. The Buddha is and like I said, I'll talk more about this and we'll probably see some of these photos again. It's just a very different form of worship than I'm actually used to or comfortable with. Is there one more, Luke? I'll save that one. So hold that photo. Yeah. very interesting. When I was talking with someone, they said, boy, when you travel, you want to be aware of the religious background of the people. He said, for example, if you go to a Buddhist world, plan on going to a place where the rights of people are not upheld. He said, I have a very hard time traveling to the Buddhist world, he said, because the rights of women and children are so abused. And if you think about it, that comes from the philosophy of it's their fault. They're in this position because of something they did in a past life. We can't help them because they deserve everything they get. So if you have women trafficking and child prostitution, that happens in these lands because of the religious philosophy. One of our guides called it a cosmetic culture. Very interesting comment. When you go to Thailand, you think, oh, this is, you know, the people are so nice. Because when you meet them, they seem very polite, and they're very calm and quiet people. And they do this little bow thing where they, instead of shaking hands, they put both fingers together and kind of bow down. You feel very honored. You feel very welcomed. But when you think about the underlying part of this, that's where the cosmetic culture becomes so interesting, where it looks beautiful on the surface, but underneath, it's nothing but rotting bones. The bow, it turns out, is a prescribed event. And I think, for example, if you meet the king, you have to bow all the way down to the ground, put your face in the ground. But even the amount of bow that you do depends on your status in society. So when we met with a group of Thai people, we were told how far to put our head down. If you go too far, you're being too subservient. Very interesting. You feel like, oh, that's almost a form of layers of society, which, of course, coming from a Western culture, we say, oh, no, everybody's equal. Not here. If you bow too deeply, you're giving too much honor to somebody who's really below you. Very interesting. And like I said, I will talk further about Buddhism, this religion that has 1.25 billion believers. 1.25 billion, wow. Next photo, Luke, please. This is Cambodia. So we started in Singapore. We're making our way up the coast of this Southeast Asia. These here are spirit houses, and I'm sorry the photo's not better. we were flying by in our car and I said, oh, quick, John, take a photo. Basically, these are houses that in this part of the world, every home has and every business has. And there's this prescribed set of workmen that get together and they're only allowed to build these houses that welcome spirits to come and live on your property. If you have a business, you want a rich giving spirit to come and live with you. I don't know enough about this either, but the idea of worship, bringing in spirits, welcoming in spirits is just another part of this world that's so different and so non-Western. Next row, this is the highway to the capital. We visited the capital of Phnom Penh. It's a two-lane road, there's just an enormous amount of traffic on it. Everything from cows that are crossing the road, lots of motorbikes, big buses, big trucks that have to transport everything. And if you need to pass, you take your life in your hands because there's people also coming from the other way. It's quite an experience, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. Again, more pictures of the traffic traveling to the capital. This is the main highway in Cambodia. You're talking a poor part of the world. And I think on this back picture, you can see the one line of electricity there. In Cambodia, only the factories have electricity. None of the homes do. So when you drive through the villages, they'll have the TV lit, but it's lit by a car battery. And you'll see somebody coming by with their little cart like this, and they're transporting a whole set of car batteries that they'll drop off to all these village homes. It's just a poorer part of the world. The next picture is, we visited while we were in the capital, a prison that had been built by Pol Pot back in 1975, between 1975 and 1978. Pol Pot was a Cambodian, if you've heard of the Killing Fields, he was the key proponent of this, who was very intrigued with communism and really desired to return Cambodia from Western ideas, from progress, from moving forward back to their agrarian roots. And under Pol Pot, they would collect people off the street, anybody who had an education or wore eyeglasses or was religious in any sense, and they'd put them in these little cells and they would torture them in this particular place. They figured there were about 68 prisons like this scattered throughout Cambodia, which is not at all a big country. And they believe, they don't know exactly, but they believe between 1.5 and 3 million people died during this three-year period of time. That they figure that's between a fourth and a third of the entire population of the land. So when you go to this prison, when Cambodians go to this prison, they cry because they know people that died during this period of time. This is in our period of life. And his dream, again, was to return the country to the agrarian society. Again, control. It's easier to control people that are illiterate. It's easier to control people that don't depend on government for permits to get government going. Very sad time. He was very captured. Pol Pot was very captured with the whole Chinese cultural revolution. It's mind-boggling even to think about the death of that. The rivers were flowing blood and bodies, and they don't have any idea how many people died because so many died. You'll see pictures of piles of skulls. That's from this period of time. Very, very sad. Next slide. Cambodia and Vietnam both have what they call a sidewalk culture. And what that means is when we go shopping, we'll go drive to King Supers and we park our car and go into the store. Here, all of the shops are on the ground level of whatever building is there. So you can see that this is probably a three-story building. And there's like a big garage door like we have in our warehouse, and they'll open that up and put an awning over it and pull out some plastic chairs and you're set up for business. And hopefully you can attract the people that are driving by. That's why they call it a sidewalk culture. So you have lots of little shops, little restaurants, little places to eat. Sometimes you'll see a whole collection of shops that are set up for a particular type of industry. So maybe there's a building section. Instead of going to Lowe's, you'll go to the one shop and buy sinks, and you'll go to the next shop and buy bamboo poles to build your structure, and you go to the next building to buy your pipes that you need to put your sink into place. Very different than how we have it here. The next one, back up one more, sorry, Luke. And then the third, the one thing that John did not get a photo of, but is very interesting to me, you'll have in both Vietnam and Cambodia beautiful gardens. They're just lush and gorgeous, and either rice paddies or rows and rows of vegetables. And right in the middle of those, there are grave sites, beautifully decorated places that their ancestors have been, right in the middle of their gardens. Prime property, right? Property is always key. Basically, they believe that if they honor their ancestors, again, it's a form of spirit worship. If they honor their ancestors, then hopefully they'll have good fortune or good luck. Just a very different even way of thinking. We want to honor our parents, of course, but we certainly don't want to pray to them and hope that their spirits come back and help us have good luck. Next picture is Vietnam. We started in the former city called Saigon, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City. Since it's still often called Saigon, I would prefer to use that. It's a city of 8 million people. To give you a comparison to that, the entire state of Colorado has 5 million people. This is a very crowded, very busy city. And I think, as well as 8 million people, I think they have 8 million scooters. It's just, I've never been in a city that just, the streets are just swarming. And the traffic rules don't exist. I mean, you don't have traffic lights. So everybody's just, it's this amazing dance as you're driving. It's absolutely amazing. And they'll be talking on their cell phones. Anyway, it's amazing. Vietnam, I was very intrigued to go to that land. And it turns out that Vietnam is one of four communist countries remaining in this world. The four are China, Vietnam, North Korea, Cuba. Now, I'm old enough to know that there was this time in my life when we thought communism was going to take over the world. It was going to just explode, and we were all going to be communist at one point in time. We, of course, at this end of history, can say that is not true. But Vietnam is still a communist land. If you go to the next one, Luke. We had the chance to visit with some communist Christians. I'm sorry, with some Vietnamese Christians. We ended up going to a Vietnamese Christian church on Sunday morning. Church on Sunday starts at 5 a.m. or 6 or 7 a.m. We chose the 6 a.m. of course, we couldn't understand anything that was done, but the service felt very familiar, very similar to what we had done. Some of the songs were obviously Western songs that had been translated, so I sang along in English. John tried to sing along in Vietnamese. Vietnamese is a tonal language. It has 5 tones. So you can say a word like this, or like this, or like this, and it means 3 different things. So I don't know what he was singing, but he was at least he was at least making a joyful noise. This is one of the churches that we visited out in the countryside. It was built on land donated by a believer in this area. The congregation is strong, but because it's Vietnam, even though they've owned the land, they've built the building, they're not convinced they'll be able to keep it. Vietnamese laws require that you have a place for the pastor. They want the pastor and his family living on the same land as the church. And if you can see this piece of property, this is the full property. There really isn't room for a pastorate. And it's quite a conundrum for them. They're thinking, well, we really don't want to lose this building that has been sacrificially built by believers that live here. If you go to the next one, that's the, and this is right next door to the church. The man who actually donated the land lives there. Anyway, next one is the inside of the church. Very simple, but in a land where all religion has been banned. Communism, of course, resists anything religious. They deny it. They don't allow it. And the Christian churches, if you feel compelled, please pray for them. They said that the pastors of these churches make very little money. If you think about poor land, when they go to work, it's just a huge sacrifice on their behalf. At one point, I asked one of the pastors we were talking with, so what do you do for the orphans and the widows? He said, they're on their own. We're just barely scrappling by as it is. And so the one thing that, as we drove through Vietnam, and remember I had mentioned that both Cambodia and Vietnam had those spirit houses and the temples. You have none of that in Vietnam. Turns out that all of those spirits houses came into the people's homes so that they could stay out from under the radar of the government. So in times of control from the government, all of that goes underground, even in Vietnam here. Oh, let's see, what's the next one? Oh, the next one, here, yeah. We visited the Chu Chi tunnels. Vietnam, do you remember, we were at war with Vietnam in the 60s, I believe it was in the early 70s, I should have looked up the date. Saigon was an area of great fighting, and the tunnels were a huge underground home for many of the Vietnamese, and they would walk, and I can't remember how far we drove to get to these tunnels, but it's at least 20 miles, maybe, from the city of Saigon. So the Vietnamese soldiers would come to these tunnels, which were small. In fact, they've had to widen them for the big visitors that come. And there's three levels of these tunnels underground, and they've been dug in the rock so that when the Air Force would come in and bomb these tunnels, you know, that didn't have any impact because the people would be so much further underground. So they had all these little coverings, and you could come up and attack. Actually very difficult to see, mainly because I had friends that fought in Vietnam. And what they would do is they had weapons that they would use. For example, a bomb would drop and it wouldn't explode. They'd carefully cut it apart and make spikes that they would put in the ground and soldiers would fall on them. And, you know, it was to see all of that, it's just very interesting to go to a place where you've lost the war. Because they start with showing you this video and it says, you know, the rotten Americans, you know, it's kind of this thing, and I'm sitting in the front row thinking, wow, am I uncomfortable sitting here? Because I am about as obviously American as they get. And of course, there's no commentary about of why the Americans came, you know, to try to stop the progression of communism. They came at the request of the South Vietnamese. There's none of that. It's just the Americans' fault. So the people who write history, the people who win, get to write their history. I thought it was very interesting to see this from a very different perspective. And they were very daunting. Here's a picture of one of the tunnels, and like I said, they'd been widened for the heavy Americans. And this is where they lived. They lived underground and then would come up at night and go and attack U.S. forces in the city of Saigon and then run back to these tunnels and hide. Very interesting. Okay, now we're into, this is still Vietnam. Again, another example of the sidewalk culture. See where you can have the shops at the very bottom level and then the people live in the upper levels. Very poor, as you can see. Okay, final stop for us. Here we are in Hong Kong. Hong Kong, too, is a beautiful, beautiful city. Of course, it was ruled by the British for a number of years. Has a gorgeous, gorgeous skyline. And I think the next one is also the skyline. This is all the beautiful city of Hong Kong. Next one too, Luke, here we go. This is the skyline at night. Every night they do this light show. It's a very busy next picture. You know, beautiful city, but the next picture is very crowded. They say Hong Kong is the most crowded spot on earth. And we happened to be there just before Chinese New Year. And this is the flower market, and everybody buys flowers for Chinese New Year. So we were jostled, I think the next one shows it as well, jostled and pushed around as part of the crowd. It was quite an experience. This is a picture of the subway, and I wanted to show this because it shows the difference between a planned community and, you know, places where we've been, where you've got a two-lane highway that's not going very well. Their subway system is, I think it's probably the finest I've ever ridden in. When you come off of, I don't know how many of you have ridden a subway before, but basically usually when you come off a subway train, you either have to go upstairs or downstairs to make your next connection, because the lines run in different ways, and they've built them. Anyway, in Hong Kong, when you come off of one subway, you walk across a hall and you step on the next train. And it's basically timed so that you have enough time to walk from this one to this one. Never seen anything like it. I said to someone, you know, do they run every 10 minutes? He looked at me and he said, if they ran every 10 minutes, it'd be in the paper because it would be a national tragedy. They run every 3 minutes and they are full like this every time they run. We were going to walk 10 blocks at one point. Somebody said, oh, let's just get on the subway. You know, it's just efficient and fast and easy to use. Everybody uses it. My brother lives in Hong Kong. He said, I was going to get a car. He said, but the mass transportation's so cheap and so easy. I decided I wouldn't even bother to do that. Next picture, it's Hong Kong. Whereas the city is this gorgeous city, it is surrounded by beautiful countryside. You can take a train and walk in national parks, and this is the type of scenery that you'll see here. It's actually a very pretty place. We met with a man who seeks to, while we were in Hong Kong, who seeks to smuggle Bibles into China. John said to him, why in the world do you need to do that? Because the Chinese actually have a printing company called Anmity that prints Bibles for the Chinese. And that man looked at us and he said, you know, when the Chinese talk about printing Bibles, they give you a number. They'll say, oh, we have printed 10 million Chinese Bibles. He said, the problem with that number is that's how many they've printed since they started printing Bibles, which was in 1985. And that is the total number they have printed. Now, you and me, we go, wow, 10 million Bibles, that's a lot of Bibles. That's because we don't live in China, where there are between 100 and 150 million Chinese believers. 10 million Bibles is a drop in the bucket. Doesn't even begin to touch the need. And when Amity prints Bibles, they put them in bookstores in the big cities. Well, China is, it's about as big as the United States. There's huge cities in China, but there's an awful lot of countryside as well. If you happen to live in the countryside, it is not at all easy to go to the city and buy yourself a Bible, even if you know about them. It's interesting, the Chinese government talks about, oh, we're even printing Bibles for other countries. And they use that as a ploy to say, look how righteous and how free we are. And our friend said, but how does that help Chinese believers get the Bibles they need? Suppose China's actually building, printing Bibles for the United States or for whoever knows who they'd be printing them for. So that doesn't help their own countrymen. They make the Amity Press also prints a very nice study Bible. Maybe we all have one in our home. But they printed 10,000 of them. Logistics of how to get Bibles into the hands of people who have never had them is always very challenging. That's basically what I have. It's a brief snapshot of some of the things that we saw. It's a different part of the world. I'm grateful that we pray in the morning for these different parts of the world because they need our prayers. It's a different part of the world. Thank you. And I do